Unpolished Little Gems, Episode 6, Confusion. Andrea is having one of those days. Chocolate stars Sarah Wright as Andrea and was written by Tracy Haywood.
I've had quite the day today. It all started with chocolate. Well, a need for chocolate. I woke up bloated and miserable, and I knew what was coming. I needed chocolate. And every time I tried to get out to the shops, I got an angry call from this one client, Marvin Hughes. Andrea, he booms. He's an actor, you see, the RSC, that sort of thing, and he booms. Everything is a dramatic performance with Marvin. Since the lockdown, he has called me 42 times. 42. Andrea, he booms, I want an interview with One Show. If they want to speak to Simon Callow, they want to speak to me. I represent the theatre. I should speak for it at this time of crisis. Andrea, speak to my publisher. Now is the time to hear from a seasoned actor how to stay calm. Pitch that to them, will you? Andrea, I want you to set up a meeting with the editor of The Stage. Tell them I will write an article on forging a career in the face of adversity. And tell my fascinating story of resilience and talent. He never emails. He only calls. He has admonished me for sending him emails. Andrea, call Mr. Kipling and offer my support. Where do I start with that? At 5 p.m, I had a moment's peace. I had called the booker at the One Show, his publisher's assistant, the sub-editor for The Stage, and I was still working out what to do with Mr. Kipling. I get my shoes on, go to the shops for chocolate, and as I reach for my coat, the phone rings again. It's the One Show's casting assistant. Hello, Andrea. Thanks so much for your call. We would love to interview Marvel for our theatre TV spot tonight. Och, that's fantastic news, I said. How do we set this up? Oh, we will just call him via Zoom and broadcast that, she replies. Oh, that's great news. I'll let him know, I reply. So, I call up Marvin, expecting him to be excited. And instead, he responds with, Andrea, you have 2 hours to set this up. You've left this far too late. Are they going to call me on the house telephone then? What proceeded next was a 2-hour frantic phone call where I explained to an elderly, cyber-illiterate actor how to download and install Zoom onto his ancient computer. Right, Marvin, is it on? Is it on? Right, open up your internet. Your internet. Okay. Go to the start button. It's on the bottom left. No. What can you see in the bottom left-hand side of your screen? No, the left. Okay, click on that. Okay, tell me what you see. An hour later. Click download and then you should see a box open up. No, you can't see it. Well, it's a box. A little box. It's a little square window. Can you see a little square window? Okay, it should say something like, do you want to download? And you need to click on a button that says, like, run or download. Marvin, stay focused. Now, can you see a box or a window? It's this thing on the screen, a pop-up. It's a pop-up, but can you see it? It's a pop-up. 45 minutes later, you need to enter the meeting code in the box. The meeting code is in the email. Just copy and paste it. Okay. Type it up. Go back to your browser, the internet, the page with your Zoom account on. You don't know what you're looking at. Okay, go back to the internet. Are you there? Okay. Where it says meeting code, you need to type this in. A, Z, B, 4, 8, M, 1, 4, G, Z, 9, 4, M, B. And then the password. L, J, 4, 9, 4, 8, 7. Then click OK. Does that work? No, what does it say? Meeting code not recognised, okay? Let's try again. In the meeting code, you need to type A, Z, B. 2 minutes before his interview, we get him into the meeting. So I watched Marvin do this one show interview. I called him afterwards to congratulate him on his appearance, and he gave me a list of 20 shows he wanted me to contact tomorrow, which I promised I would do. Then finally, I got my trainers on and rushed down to the corner shop. I had it pictured in my mind all day, this big bar of chocolate. I had it in my grasp, the beautiful nectar of the gods. But there's a queue of about 20 people weaving down this shop, this sad little snake of a queue. So I wait for 20 minutes. Finally, I reach the till with my chocolate bar and they tell me, "No card, love." I say, "I'm sorry, what? Card machine is playing up, we've had to go cash only." I check my wallet and there are coins. I count them out. 64p. The chocolate bar is £1.40. I hope they will take pity on me. And I proclaim sadly, "Oh, I only have 64 pence. To which the newsagent guy replies, "Cash point's down the road." "Oh, yes, I know where the cash point is." I begin and use all my strength to plaster on a smile. "But, is there any possible way I could pay back tomorrow, perhaps? I'm in here, like, all the time." "No, you need to pay for the item," he replies. I look mournfully at the queue to see if anyone will take pity on me, but all the customers in earshot are determined not to make eye contact. They're all staring at the ceiling as if there's some secret message for them up there. So I leave. I walk to the cash point, I get my £10 note, get back inside the newsagents, I pick up my chocolate bar and return to the till. "Oh, hello," I say to the newsagent, "I'm back." And it's a different guy in the tills. His stare just permeates indifference as he says distractedly, "You need to queue?" I put on the smile again and say, "Oh, right. Obviously you wouldn't know this, but I was just here in the queue for like 20 minutes. I didn't have the cash, so I had to leave and get the cash, but I am already in the queue. I've already queued, so is there any way I can..." And he gives me the stare again. And I give up and return to the back of the queue. An hour after I left the house, I'm back home. It's 9 p.m. I can't be bothered to cook anything, so I just run a bath and make another slice of toast while I get ready. I get my essential oils out, my candle, wine and the chocolate. And I get the music playing on the phone. As I've been up since 7:30 and I've had 2 pieces of toast all day, the wine hits me immediately. And I lean back into the bath and relax. Half an hour later, I've had half of my chocolate and I'm on my second glass of wine and I am relaxed, finally. I lean my head back on the top of the bath, close my eyes and sing along to Dolly Parton's Jolene. Then, midway through the chorus, the singing stops and is replaced by the sound of my telephone ringing. "Marvin!" I yell and haul myself into a standing position in the bath and reach for my phone on the bathroom shelf and stare accusingly at the screen. It's not Marvin, it's my boss, Andy. The call is coming through Messenger somehow. I'm not sure what's going on, but I press a button to answer the call, and all of a sudden, the screen is split in two. Half with Andy's face, with a headset on, and half is me, Me and my naked, dripping body hunched over the phone, glaring angrily into the screen. Andy is mortified, as am I. I thought it was a voice call, I shout, trying to work out how to switch the camera off. I wouldn't have answered if I knew it was a video. I scream. I'm trying to press all the icons, trying to turn off the camera. I'm trying to end the call and I can't even find the hang-up symbol on the phone, so I just end up shouting once more, I wouldn't have answered if I knew it was a video. I get out of the bath, heart racing, and rush to my bedroom to find this text. It's flat in tone, as if nothing had happened. It says, "Congrats on Marvin's interview tonight. Quick thinking to get that booking so fast. Let's have a call tomorrow to go through your books and think about other opportunities for interviews." "Great," I reply, and he emails out a meeting request for 9 a.m. So, now, I am in an unusual dilemma. Is it going to be more awkward or less awkward if I mention it tomorrow?
An eerie encounter disrupts Rupert Buford's Arctic expedition. Mixed Signals was written and produced by Tasman Pinder and performed by Ian Reid.
This is a recording of Rupert Beaufort for the British Antarctic Survey Archives, AD6251, on the 16th of March 2020. My name is Rupert Beaufort. I was born on the 18th of January 1955. I joined the British Antarctic Survey, or BAS as they are known, in 1975. Before this, I'd been working as a chef in Michelin-starred restaurants in London, Switzerland and Paris, where I trained under Raymond Blanc. I always knew I had a talent for cooking. As one of six boys, I used to help my mother in the kitchen at home. We'd bake bread loaves at the weekends, wrapping them in newspaper, and when I came home from boarding school in the holidays, I'd delight in rummaging through the pantry, modifying mother's recipe books to create weird and wonderful dishes for my brothers, and for mum and dad, of course. The kitchen was a site of exploration. It was where I felt most truly creative and fulfilled. My ex-wife, Cassie, she was the one who suggested I train professionally. After boarding school, I'd planned for a career as an artist, but, well, when I submitted my portfolio to Glasgow Art College, the master said I had no natural talent for it, so then I knew for certain. A life as a chef was where I belonged. I was offered a job at a 5-star hotel in Switzerland, the Grand Hotel. Cassie lived there with me during the summer, and at the end of the year we'd planned to return to London, where I knew from my colleague Michael Schmidt that a restaurant in the Ivy Group was taking on new chefs, and I knew Michael would give me a stellar reference. Things would have been so different if I'd... But Cassie... What happened with her, it changed things for me. Cassie's family don't drink. They are exemplars of abstinence. Kitchens are stressful environments, and I suppose on reflection I wasn't the best husband. Perhaps I could have done things differently, but she really wasn't perfect either. She made my drinking out to be some kind of sin. She had this way of shrinking a person into nothing. As if I wasn't already ashamed, already guilty, already loathing myself. And then she left. She left me for Michael Schmidt. Well, at that point, he'd just taken over at Orpheus, his Mayfair restaurant. He was doing quite well at the time. Orpheus had 3 Michelin stars. He's since lost one, and I hear he's having tax problems. But anyway, I digress. At the time, it was very upsetting. Well, that was when I saw the advert for a chef working on board a ship for the British Antarctic Survey, and I thought, why not? Well, of course, I knew about Scott and Shackleton. As a lad, I'd read all about them and their adventures. I didn't know much about Antarctica, but Bobby Jones, a boy who'd been at my boarding school, had joined up with BAS. My mother was friends with his, and I used to go over there and play with his wonderful model railway set. I remember that we used to skate in the lake at Rannoch when it froze over, our mothers having wrapped us up tightly in mittens and layers of wool, warm fleeces and duffel coats. I'd seen Bobby's black and white photos of Antarctica. They were spectacular, and so I thought, why not? Bobby, unfortunately, died out there. He fell down a crevasse. And that was a few years before I went out. Bobby's mother was never sure about the BAS version of events. Not that she thought they deliberately misled her. It was more a feeling that the authorities had fudged the truth to protect her. You see, there was no record of Bobby's death back on the base. For every incident, there's always a record. So it was odd, the whole thing. They sent me out to the South Orkneys first, and 2 months later to the base at Cygni, Antarctica. That was to be my home for the next 3 years. It was an incredible place. I went through 15 reels of film in the first 2 weeks I was there, taking photos of the penguins and the sea leopards against the ice, all on my Kodak Instamatic camera. They laughed at me for having that camera, but it sufficed. Every base had a dark room and equipment for printing, you see. But you have to be careful, they told me. You have to remember that you're dealing with wild animals out there. In fact, a lady Fid, as they call the crew on the base, was once killed by a sea leopard. They get angry, protective of their young. If they feel threatened, well, you need to keep your wits about you. There wasn't a lot to work with in terms of ingredients at the base. I tried to keep up the crew's spirits with the resources we had. My tinned peaches and curry sauce became a thing of legend. It was frustrating that every time I baked bread, the hungry Fids would wolf it down whilst it was still resting on the side. I got pretty sick of this. So one day I added green food colouring to the dough so that when the bread came out of the oven, it looked mouldy. Well, that put them right off. Penguins were in abundance, but we never killed them, never cooked them. The eggs we ate, though, fried up, and under the ice fish, delicious. Of course, we had tinned fruit and vegetables, dehydrated vegetables, seabirds like giant petrels I sometimes served up, stewed with tinned vegetables. That dish always went down a storm. Of course, it sometimes got lonely out there. Feels like you're at the edge of the world, looking out across that vast expanse of snow. We had a ham radio, though, to keep in contact with the outside world, so we weren't completely cut off. I remember one time I got through to my mother. It was when I first got out there, and I hadn't had the heart to tell her about Cassie. "Antarctica? I thought you were in Salisbury," she said. That took some explaining. Oh, and I once got through to the King of Jordan. If you can believe it, he was on another channel and somehow the signals got crossed. Well, we didn't chat for long, but it's amazing to think of it now. And well, after a while I had to stop with the radio. They made me stop. The BAS officials. I became a little bit obsessed, I suppose you could say. It was after, well, there was this one day when I heard something. Something strange. Something that to this day I've never been able to explain. Not rationally. Well, at least not with the type of logic we apply to things we don't understand in this world.
Rupert Belfort, British Antarctic Survey, can you hear me? Over. Hello, can you hear me? My name's Rupert Belfort. Can you hear me?
As I listened, I knew it couldn't possibly be, but all the same, I knew that voice. I was certain. Bobby? Is that you, Bobby? We talked across the radio channel, and then he told me about the accident. The ground had slipped away under his feet, and Bobby, well, that was when he fell. Well, they should have sent dogs to check for crevasses first, but they roped up a man and sent him down to bring Bobby back. Only, well, he was too badly injured on account of the fall to, even if they'd been able to get him out of the ice, his injuries were so bad that he wouldn't have lived. So they left him down there. There was no choice. Poor Bobby. Over the years, I've thought a lot about those FIDs, knowing that they'd left a man alive down there. And after a while, the radio signal scrambled. I tried to tune it back to find the channel, but Bobby had gone. When I came back to the ship, I told the FIDs, "Sometimes the extreme temperatures play tricks with a man's mind," they said. And I was sent to see the medic. Acute hypothermia. I spent the next 5 days in bed with heat packs and thermals. BAS wouldn't make an official report of what I'd heard, and my log was also struck from the record. But I know what happened. I'm certain it was Bobby I heard on the radio that day. Not just because of his voice on the channel. You see, after the radio signal scrambled and his voice disappeared, something happened. The sky lit up with a myriad of fluorescent green and pink lights which flashed all around me. I'm not a religious man, but I knew it was Bobby that night, calling out to me, painting the sky. Ta-da!